I had a very interesting conversation with a man seated next to me at the lunch counter yesterday at a local restaurant. And I don't always chat with people in situations like that, but he sort of started and wanted to talk about baseball first, then a little bit of football. I mean, it's just innocuous kind of stuff. So I kind of went with him. You know, I can't go too far in those conversations. Enough to keep up a little bit. And then he said something just briefly. It's like an aside comment about something that his family had been going through. And I caught that and I pressed in a little bit. Gently, just opening a space for him. And he told me his story. And I won't go through all of it now, but basically his family has faced a terrible tragedy in which his son-in-law, a state trooper, was killed while on the side of the interstate tending to an accident not that long ago. And his daughter has a 2-year-old, and she has a child to be born almost any day now, and the father never knew that she was expecting. And he said, every day I'm with the 2-year-old, and I care for the 2-year-old, and he said, every day that that man is in court, I am in court. I mean, we went from sports to really deep stuff quickly. And he said, you know, I'm really sorry to burden you with this. I said, you're not burdening me with this. I said, you've walked through a terrible tragedy. And I said, besides, this is kind of what I do. What do you mean? So we opened some conversation. He wanted to know how long I'd lived here, if I'd raised my kids here. He only lives a couple blocks from me. He says, you know what's amazing? He says, you know what I think is like one of the greatest places in this whole area? Just real people, just wonderful. He says, I'm over there like 3 times a week. I said, what's that? He goes, Highwood. And all of a sudden, our stories started to come together. And I shared with him more about who we are as a community and what we're doing and invited him to be a part of things and just said we would be praying for him. I mean, you know, we were 2 tacos in. That was it, you know. And but it reminded me that he was just waiting for someone to listen. He was waiting for someone to honor his tragedy that he had walked through. That he is walking through, someone to acknowledge his story. Do we know how powerful story is? Do we know our own story? I mean, do we have a sense of the story of our lives and the many ingredients to that story? Are we aware, as Dan Allender says, that we don't just have a story, but that our life is a story? And that story has an author, and it has a way that it's to be listened to, and a way that it's to be written into the future as well. You know, we're living in a time when people are intrigued to know the fuller details of their stories. What are the things in the past that we might have missed? The people that have lived before us, the things that they did. Parts of the story that we don't know, or maybe we've forgotten, or maybe we just want to understand ourselves better. And so we investigate all the many self-revealing tools out there to get a sense of our own personalities and so on. You know, there's a lot of those, right? I meet somebody every day that it's made a new discovery of the Enneagram, and they want to talk about it. Maybe our story is in DNA. Do you know that by the start of this year, more than 26 million people had conducted an in-home DNA test to learn more about themselves, to learn more about their family's origins, their story? I did this a couple of years ago. My family presented it to me as a birthday present, Christmas present. Anyway, those are close enough times, so you know, sometimes I don't know the difference. And I did that. Actually, it took me a long time. That little kit sat in the kitchen for months. And the kids would say, have you done that yet? I think I didn't want to know. I didn't want to know who was in my past. There was this thought that, well, you know, based on my name and my family's where we've come from and so on, that maybe I'm partly Jewish. There was this sort of thought that, you know, let's check it out. No, not at all. Came back, nada, nothing. Susan had hers tested. She's getting more Jewish. So that, but it's just those kinds of things. People are doing this. Henry Louis Gates hosts one of public TV's most popular programs, Finding Your Roots. It uses DNA, it uses written and oral records to reveal to guests, they're celebrities usually, always, to reveal to them things about their own stories that they had no idea about. And it's often emotionally moving because there's a sense that the new knowledge will impact the way that they will live their life going forward. It's like, I didn't know that about my grandmother. Wow. It also sometimes has a downside. Poor Elizabeth Warren, presidential hopeful, who told a version of her own story that had to be walked back, right? Because it turned out it wasn't quite true, wasn't quite right. Stories are powerful. And the stories that we live by determine the kind of life that we'll live. The stories we believe about ourselves. Stories not only reveal, but they shape. Right? Robert Cole said the most helpful counsel that he received when he was starting out as a young psychiatrist was given to him by an elderly doctor who came to him because he saw him struggling with data, you know, like trying to like get all the data about people just right. And he said, the people who come to see us bring us their stories. They hope they tell them well enough so that we understand the truth of their lives. They hope we know how to interpret their stories correctly. And we have to remember that that's what we hear. What we hear is their story. Now, why start here today? Well, it's because that's what I believe we're encountering in Hebrews chapter 11. Stories, part of a larger encompassing story that the writer reminds us of so that we're going to live in a certain way, so that we'll have a certain response, so we'll be encouraged and challenged to follow them, to take up our place just as they took their place. Now, I'm aware that most people in church don't have an easy relationship with the book of Hebrews. Dana Harris aside, who did a lot of her doctoral work in this. Because in many ways, it's different than other writings in the New Testament, right? I mean, the language is different. It calls up people who are different. It's one long, sustained, and artful argument on the supremacy of Christ and his ministry, his priesthood, our place in him. But, you know, many Christians were far removed from these characters, Melchizedek, Jephthah, Barak, and so on. And it doesn't come up very often in the three-year cycle of the lectionary, at least here at Redeemer, it doesn't. So it's one of the reasons that 5 years ago we offered an intensive study in the book of Hebrews as part of Core at Nine. I like the way biblical scholar Fred Craddock talks about the distance that people have with Hebrews. And he says he thinks it has something to do with its place in the canon, that is, the order of books in the New Testament. He said, in a New Testament of 251 pages, Hebrews begins on page 208. Justified or not, a position near the end is read by many as a value judgment, he said. The reader of the New Testament moves through the Gospels, Acts, and Paul's writings as a traveler on a well-lighted street. Not quite familiar, but providing enough names and addresses so as to remove the sense of one's being a stranger. However, once past Paul, the traveler finds the road uncertain, the houses dimly lit, and no familiar landmarks. The temptation is to stop and turn back to the Gospels, Acts, and Paul. After all, for these areas, there are excellent maps. But Hebrews 11, that is this chapter that we have a portion of in front of us, I think that's pretty well known, even if folks are a little shady on the rest of the book. And it's the portion of Hebrews that outlines the heroes of the faith, right? It addresses the acts of faith that various people in the Bible carried out. From Abel to Noah to Abraham, Moses, Rahab, and others, they are exemplars of faith. They're remembered precisely because of the faithful posture of their lives. They lived with eyes that saw the greater purposes of God, and the promises of God, the things they hoped for, although they could not yet see them. It was their faith in God and the things that God had promised that gave shape and direction to their lives. They weren't giving attention just to their own immediate interests and concerns. They were looking forward. As it states in chapter 11 earlier, they were looking for a homeland, a better country, a heavenly one. And their faith underscored their status as strangers and exiles on the earth. In fact, it's faith that sets that up, and it's something we see again in Ephesians 2 and 1 Peter 1, this very powerful sense that we don't belong here. The faithful are not from here, and the faithful are not staying here. Their home is somewhere else. In other words, their faith in God, his promise to them, caused them to long for their true home, and their actions followed suit. They saw something in the distance that they were reaching for, even though they didn't receive it in their own lifetime. This is faith. And faith is not a belief in the mind only. I think we're often sort of led to think sometimes about that kind of definition of faith. It is that, but it's a posture of the heart. It's an action of the body that follows as well. Abraham and the others lived by faith. What they did was determined by the story they knew and the story they embraced. And it became embodied in the story of their lives, individually and together as faithful people. Now, we had the first part of Hebrews 11 in last week's readings. Really, you should read the whole thing all the way through. The lectionary splits it up, and we don't even get all of it. But the second part we have today leading us into chapter 12. And our understanding, I think, of Hebrews 11 is determined to a large degree on whether we know the stories of the people that are sort of cryptically thrown in front of us here. In other words, did we pay enough attention in Sunday school to know who these people are or were? And so we have the passage here in front of us, and I want to share a few things from that. You know, crossing the Red Sea, which is the first one that we have mentioned here in verse 29, I think we're pretty familiar with the Exodus. If we've not read it enough, we've certainly seen the movie. Don't recommend it as, you know, exegesis, but it's, you know, most people know that story anyway. What about Rahab? Rahab lived in Jericho. She assisted the Israelites in conquering the city by betraying her own people. She hid spies. She protected their lives. Do you know Barak? Not that one. The one from the book of Judges. Judges chapter 4. A military leader who defeated the Canaanite armies. Or Jephthah, a victorious leader who ruled as a judge in Israel, who led numerous military victories because he believed in the might of God. And then the writer stops naming names after a bit and just leads us in a litany of circumstances that was faced by those who were faithful. Some we can put names to, others are more obscure, but they are all true examples of how the faithful lived out their stories before God and others. And here are a few things from this passage. One thing I'm struck by is how faith tells their story through the lens of grace. Faith tells their story through the lens of grace. I mean, there are a number of some mighty heroes here, but this isn't the whole story, is it? I mean, if we dig into these people, we have a little different idea of who they were. Almost all of them, not all, but almost all of them have some mark against them or a question that has to do with the circumstances in which they found themselves or maybe about their character. I mean, Abraham was often fearful and manipulative, wasn't he? Jacob was shifty. Moses was a murderer, and he had anger issues his whole life. Rahab was a sex worker. Barak, interesting, his story, he did not receive the glory of his victory. He went to war against the Canaanite king, and he was victorious, but he set out to kill that enemy king, and he didn't. Instead, a woman lured him into her tent and killed him by driving a stake through his head. Yes, good Sunday school reading, that one. So in a way, the glory of that victory was not Barak's. Samson was strong, wasn't he? But he allowed himself to be seduced away from his vows. And yet here he is. Jephthah issued an ill-advised vow and prophecy. that ended up claiming the life of his daughter who was sacrificed. David was a rapist and a murderer. Samuel was ambivalent as a prophet, certainly about Saul. You know, these are all question marks, or at least they're concerns. But Hebrews is not written with asterisks in the margin. There's not even a hint that there was anything other than their faithful obedience at work. It says they move from weakness to strength because of faithfulness. There's no lurking scandal that their record may have been due to steroids or some other performance-enhancing substance. Right? Their story is written through the lens of grace, a lens that preferences faithfulness, especially God's faithfulness in these situations. And I'm confident that this is how God desires to write the stories of our lives too. God wants to write our story through the lens of his grace. And it's not over till it's over. Grace does not write people off. Grace does not put people aside. Grace does not say, that person can never come around. That person will never amount to it. That person can never respond. That person can never reconcile. That person can never forgive. I mean, the lens of grace writes our stories. The lens of faith writes it through grace. And I'm so thankful for that. That's a perspective that can help us to be kind to ourselves and also to others, especially those that we may be angry with or hurt by or disappointed in. Hebrews says that all of these were well attested by their faith. In other words, grace won out in their lives. And grace is wanting to write the story of my life and yours in faithful language. Thanks be to God. But also we have an invitation to see what faith looks like here. How is faith described? I mean, we have in Hebrews 11 stories of both victory and suffering, triumph and tragedy, great accomplishment, but also defeat. I mean, there's victory over wild animals and death and victory over conflict of so many kinds. But there's also persecution here. There's also mocking and torture and imprisonment. There's martyrdom here. Maybe even the strongest thing that sticks out to me is that they were wanderers without a home. They were exiles. That is, they were treated as foreigners. They were treated with disdain, scorn, and ridicule because of their status as outsiders. And all of them, whatever the situation, were declared faithful, of whom the world was not worthy. And it's because they continued to live their lives oriented to the promise of God, sometimes in victory, sometimes in suffering. You know, it's possible to get the idea that faith is always a victory in a situation. That in faith, everything comes out the way we want it to come out. And certainly there is victory in the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. We are more than conquerors, we're told in the scriptures. But that doesn't always look the way we would desire it to look. Faith is about that vision rising above circumstance to pursue the long view, the view to God's ultimate provision, to the fulfillment of the promise that he has made. You see, there's no place in God's story for language about winners and losers. That's not biblical language. The language we have is those who are faithful or those who are not faithful. Your difficult circumstance, the thing you face today, the thing that you've spent so many hours in prayer over, is not a sign that you are being unfaithful, not necessarily, or that God is not faithful, certainly. It's a place where you, along with others standing with you in the community of God's people, can live faithfully, walking each day in trust and expectation. I thought of this just this morning as we were singing this new setting to the hymn, O Love That Will Not Let Me Go, and the story of George Matheson, the Scottish preacher who wrote the words to this. And he was visually impaired, really, I think, almost totally blind for most of his life, and he had the help of his sister, who was his the one who assisted, kind of came around and helped him to be able to do his ministry. And she got married, and as she was getting married and leaving him alone, you know, he felt the kind of the joy for her, but the loneliness of his own situation, and he penned these words. I mean, his life was one of suffering and difficulty. He preached a sermon on the book of Job to Queen Victoria, and I think that's still in print. It's a powerful testimony from someone who was faithful but knew suffering. Why does Hebrews give us this hall of fame of the faithful? Why is it here? Not just to celebrate famous men and women of the Old Testament, and not just to bestow honor on them. That's not the point. It's to link their stories with ours and to show what they looked forward to now has been fulfilled in Jesus and fulfilled in those that follow Jesus. That they didn't receive the promise is not due to any flaw in their faith. It was due to the unfolding purpose of God. The promise of God for salvation that motivated all of these faithful ones and led them forward is fulfilled now through the sacrifice and priestly intercession of Jesus Christ. Their story is ours, and our story is theirs. As Fred Craddock again notes, what is now better, the thing that was lacking before, is the completion of one's pilgrimage toward God, the gracious gift of Christ's act on our behalf. As Hebrews 10 says, "For by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified." Our faithful forebears are linked with us and us with them. They live the earlier chapters of one continuous story of which we are a part. We're not better. That's not the point. There's not a great separation there. There's a unity there. The something better has been prepared for them just as it has been for us. And their faithfulness is a witness to us, a call for us also to be faithful. And thus we have the slide into chapter 12. For us to lay aside the things that keep us from living faithfully, the weights that hold us back in our journey to follow Christ. The language here in turning to Christ is actually turn away to Christ. Away from the things that we know are harmful, separating, life-robbing, energy-zapping, joy-killing. Away from the things that we know only too well. Away from those things and to Jesus. Our eyes set on him as the one calling us to finish the race well. This is not a word, by the way, to try harder. It's not. I don't think we actually find that in the message of the gospel. Try harder. It's a call to surrender. To say yes to the draw and the invitation of God, trusting in his power through our weakness. It's a word to lay those things down. Just release them. Let them go. Know his faithfulness flowing through us. That's the picture here. You know, we're not in a solitary journey. We're not writing a personal story. There are countless ones who have gone before us, who have lived faithfully and handed the baton to us. There are those around us now who serve as faithful witnesses and those who will come after. And I wonder if we hear their voices, do we know they're part of the one story alongside ours? Certainly we have a few names here, but there are so many more. There are those who have gone before us in our families and in our churches that we've been a part of, those who prayed for us, those who made this church possible, those who continue to do so, those who taught us. Yeah, that's a powerful cloud of witnesses, isn't it? I want us to do something now that requires you to kind of do something. Besides, listen to me. I want us to take a moment. I want us to think about the people that are those people and were those people for us. Maybe it's Bible people. Maybe it's authors of Scripture. Maybe it's someone that taught us in college. Maybe it was someone early on. Maybe it was a grandparent. And I want us to begin just to say their names. Don't just shout it out. But just say their names. And we're all going to do this together until this room is full of the names of the people who've been witnesses to us. So can we begin? Just when you're ready to begin, just begin to do that. And we'll jump in. Maybe names you haven't thought about for a long time. Maybe names you think about every moment. But they're here. They're witnesses with us. Their stories lay hard on ours. And when we gather at this table every week, we hear them. They gather in the church that's now triumphant. But you know, there's a name above all of these names that we said. And most of all, He is the faithful one. He is the trustworthy one. He is the unchanging one. He is the one we look to. He is the goal at the end of our journey. His cross and His resurrection give us life and hope and joy, whether in victory or in suffering. And He is the one who is writing and completing our story. Amen.